everyone. This is Dr. Cheryl Spellman, and welcome to What Women Must Know, a show to empower you with truthful information so you can make the most informed decisions possible regarding your hormones, your health, and your overall well-being. And as always, it's such a pleasure having you with me here for this hour. We always have great conversations on this show, and we really strive to get into the heart of the matter, really address things in quite a lot of depth so you can really get the whole story and be able to understand issues and be able to put into practice practical strategies so they really make a difference in your life. I want to remind everyone, if you have not yet opted into my website, please do so, whatwomenmustknow.com. I have many free special reports. I have many free published articles on that site. There are all sorts of ongoing special announcements. It's about to change its look. I will be doing a new website in the new year, so that's a great way to start things going, which will provide you with even more information. And I also have a really active Facebook page, which is What Women Must Know, and if you just go there and like it, you will be getting ongoing tips. In fact, I've just posted and will be doing a series of postings of phenomenal holiday treats that are all healthy and safe as far as will not add to your weight or inflammation or, you know, health challenges, but are really quite yummy. So that's all happening on my Facebook page, so I hope you'll go and visit there and like it and get the information when it comes out. And I have information almost every day, lots and lots of great articles and tips. And also all of the radio shows that I do, I have this show every Monday. And then on Sunday, I have my Women's Healing Circle. That's at 4 p.m. Eastern Time. So if you'd like to catch up on the great guests that I have, leading authors and researchers, practitioners, wise elders, then if you opt into my website, you'll be able to be sent those archive shows. Or if you just go to the Facebook page, they're posted there as well. And one of the things you don't want to miss is the series that I'm presently doing on the real story behind Gardasil. You know, Gardasil is that cervical cancer vaccine. At least it's promoted as a cervical cancer vaccine. It's really a vaccine for four strains of human papilloma virus, but it's promoted as the savior for cervical cancer. And unfortunately, there are so many risks involved and so many lies that you really need to know what's going on before you would permit your daughters or now your sons to be doing this taking this vaccine. So to get the whole story, I am doing a six-part series. I've sent out three of the previous interviews. I've done in-depth interviews with, again, leading activists and researchers and practitioners and parents of children who've been seriously harmed by the vaccine. So to get this information, again, opt in to What Women Must Know, or like me at my Facebook page, because those interviews are posted there as well. And I will be doing ongoing series of things. I think it's a great opportunity to take advantage of all the great wisdom and experience and talent of the people that I encounter in my world and to share it with everyone. So I've just finished a six-part natural hormone rejuvenation series, doing the Gardasil series, and there will be more series in the future, including an ongoing series with a traditionally trained homeopath who's going to share her great secrets for using homeopathy to address so many of women's hormonal challenges. So that's coming up, and you just don't want to miss it. So all you need to do is opt in or like me on my Facebook page. So let's talk about a really important issue. Actually, it's an issue that I have been rigorously researching and applying for many, many decades. Even before I entered the world of naturopathy, I was a psychotherapist, and I would run programs called Mind, Breath, and Stress. and addressing the underlying issues that relate to stress, the impact of stress, and of course the solutions or some of the solutions to alleviate the toxic effects of stress. So it's a really interesting topic. Every single woman I've ever tested in my practice with saliva testing, which is the most effective and accurate way to assess hormones, has shown up with some stage of adrenal exhaustion. So we're all being affected by stress. That's a word we hear all the time. It almost kind of, you know, just rolls off our back. We don't really pay attention to what that means to be affected by stress. What is this thing that's called stress? What's it doing to us? So to help us really become enlightened, we're going to be talking to Thea Singer, who is the author of a new book called Stressless for Women, Calm Your Body, Slow Aging, and Rejuvenate the Mind in 5 Simple Steps. So this is going to be a great conversation. It also will be quite an educational conversation, since Thea has done such fantastic work in interviewing leading researchers, and I think everyone will be quite surprised just how far-reaching the effects of stress can be in your life, and we really need to be proactive and take the steps to reduce the stress and reduce the aging and the consequences to our health. So this is a great show, and it's my pleasure to welcome Thea Singer to the show today. Hello, Thea.
Hi there. Thank you so much for having me.
It's a pleasure, and I just want to tell everyone a little bit about you. Thea Singer has written about health and science for more than 3 decades, a contributor to More, O, the Oprah magazine, Natural Health, Boston, and The Nation. Her byline has also appeared in newspapers such as The Washington Post, The Boston Globe, and The Boston Herald. And she lives in Massachusetts. So that's a bit about Thea. And Thea, I want to congratulate you on this book. You did a really great job. Obviously, as you can tell, this is a subject that I have a great interest in.
Yes, I can tell. And that's very exciting for me to be talking to you since you're so interested in the topic. And I did a very, very extensive literature search, interviews with probably a who's who of scientists who study stress. And what I've also done in the book, when the subtitle talks about the 5 simple steps, and those are intervention chapters in which I have looked at ways that we can help reduce stress, not just how to do it, but what's happening within our bodies and our minds. So I use scientific studies, very rigorous ones, in order to see what was most effective in reducing stress, and so we could all understand why those particular interventions were effective. Because, after all, it's by knowing what's going on inside of you that you become motivated to pursue the interventions in the first place.
I agree. And like I was saying, we almost become immune to the word stress because it's just bantered around all over the place. But when people start realizing just what the consequences are, which is what I would like you to share with us in the show today, I think it will make people sit up, pay attention, and then get, you know, into action of how to take care of oneself. So you can go through a stressful situation, which is part of life, but you can do it with the resources to help you navigate through that time and stay healthy and not fall prey to the consequences of, you know, unmitigated stress.
Right. Well, why don't we start by talking a little bit about the stress response and what effect it can have on our bodies. One point that I do want to make, and that is really very encouraging, is that there are external stressors, there are circumstances, events happening we have no control over, but what we do have control over are our reactions to those events. That's called perceived stress, and I include in the book a test to test your level of perceived stress. And it's your level of perceived stress, not stress per se in and of itself, that really makes the difference.
Exactly.
What we've heard a lot about how stress can make us sick. It can contribute to many kinds of diseases, cardiovascular disease, immune system disorders, digestive problems. And we've been hearing about this for a long time. What my book, the launching pad for my book, was a remarkable study done by Nobel Prize winner Elizabeth Blackburn. She won the Nobel Prize in 2009, and UCSF health psychologist Alyssa Epple, who looked at the molecular effect of stress on our cells. And what they did was they took a group of women who were in a very, very stressful circumstance. They were caregivers of chronically ill children. And they wanted to see what effect such chronic stress had not just on their hormone levels, their cortisol levels, but also on their cells. And I'm going to backtrack a little here and give a little biology lesson. Inside our cells, of course, are our, there's a nucleus, and in the nucleus are our chromosomes. They lie on in the nucleus, kind of looking like two worms crossed at the middle. And our DNA rests on those chromosomes. That's the very substance of our being. The tips of those chromosomes also have DNA, but it's not genetic DNA. These are caps called telomeres, and they protect our chromosomes and the genetic DNA the same way that the plastic tips on the edge of shoelaces keep the shoelaces from fraying. Now, every time a cell divides, those telomeres, those caps, get a little bit shorter. And so scientists look at telomere length as a marker of biological aging, essentially how old your cells are. And for instance, when we're younger, our telomeres are longer, like when we're babies, than when we're older. People with chronic diseases, like cardiovascular disease, inflammatory diseases, generally have shorter telomeres than those who are healthy. And what Eppel and Blackburn found was that in these women who were caregivers, those who perceived themselves as being under the most stress had telomeres that were shorter by the equivalent of 10 years from those who perceived themselves as being under the least stress. So essentially, we're taking this huge psychosocial construct, stress, and we're zooming down, tunneling down to the molecular level and the damage that it can actually do to ourselves.
Because, you know, what you just said in that shortening of the telomeres, it's essentially aging us. It's accelerating our aging. So under stress and the consequences on that physiological level is causing us to age much more rapidly on that cellular level than if we weren't exposed to that constant unrelenting stress.
Absolutely, absolutely. And there are correlations, although, you know, science is very careful talking about causation versus correlation, but there are definitely correlations between cellular aging and what they call organismal aging, the whole body aging. So even though there haven't been studies specifically done on that fact, when you're talking about stress contributing to cellular aging, you really are talking about stress contributing to the whole organism, the whole being, all of us.
Exactly. I think we all see that in our own lives.
I know. It's kind of horrifying. You
kind
look
of
in the
blinding flash of the obvious, right?
Right. Yep. Well, you know, you look at Obama, what he looked like when he took office and what he looks like now. Tony Blair, when I wrote my article for Oprah magazine, we had comparison pictures of Tony Blair when he took office and, you know, after when he was leaving office. So it really has a huge effect on us. It has a huge effect on our brains. It has a huge effect on our organs. And every part of us. It has a huge effect on our skin.
Yeah. I mean, I look at Hillary Clinton and I'm shocked. I'm horrified at some of those photos. I mean, maybe it's just a bad photo. You can't always tell. But, you know, the recent photos I've seen of hers, it is a bit shocking.
Well, see, one thing that can happen from a physiological perspective is when, as I said, when a cell divides, and it's not all cells, it's skin cells, it's blood cells, the ones that replenish constantly, immune cells. When a cell divides, the telomere gets a little shorter. Now, it reaches a point eventually where it can divide no longer, and because the telomere has gotten so short. And remember, the purpose of the telomere is to protect our genetic DNA. So it would be very, very dangerous if the telomere wore away completely and the cell still existed. You'd have exposed chromosomes, which could lead to mutations, which could lead to cancer. Mm-hmm. So what happens with the cell when the telomere gets very, very short is it goes into a resting state called senescence. Now, it's not dead. It's sitting there essentially spewing out toxic stuff. Elizabeth Blackburn compared it to a rotten apple. She was being very technical at the time. And so some scientists believe that it is those toxins being released by the senescent cells, and we have more senescent cells as we get older because the cells have divided more and so are in that resting state, that it is those toxins that lead to the wrinkles and the sagging skin, because remember, elastin is what holds our skin together. So if you have an erosion of those cells, you're going to see your skin start to sag, your wrinkles getting deeper, and you're going to really see the physical effects of aging.
So, you know, you've done some great delineation in your book of different effects of stress. I'd like to go through some of those, as much as we can, actually, and have you explain how stress is impacting the various systems of our body, because I think that's really critical for people to understand, and they might be able to recognize some of the symptoms so they can appreciate why they're feeling the way they're feeling, which leads them to making, you know, proactive steps. So let's talk about stress and the brain.
Stress in the brain. Stress has a huge effect on the brain. I want to start out by saying, though, that not all stress is bad. I'm actually writing an article right now about good and bad stress. If the stress is temporary and it's acute, it's intermittent, it can actually be very good for us. Bruce McEwen, who's a guru of stress research, said to me when I was writing my book, if we didn't have stress, we'd be dead. You know, if you're going to be in a play and you're Juliet waiting for your Romeo, you don't want to be snoring away. You want to be revved up. The stress response is there for a reason. So there's good stress, exercise is good stress, sex has been found to be good stress, and good stress can have very positive effects on the brain. Good stress can actually spur neurogenesis, which is the increasing of new brain cells. So, for instance, if I'm on my treadmill at my club, I'm imagining new brain cells growing, my gray matter getting larger. So there is a good effect of stress on the brain. We get ourselves into trouble when the stress is chronic or it's repeated and it never stops. And that has a huge effect on the brain, particularly on the part of the brain called the hippocampus, which is the seat of memory consolidation and retrieval. And I don't know if your listeners have noticed or you have noticed, but I certainly have, that when I'm in a particularly overwhelmingly stressful circumstance, I start forgetting things. I was actually just last week in a pretty bad car accident, and I keep walking into rooms now and not knowing quite why I'm there. And my memory will come back. But what happens when you're stressed that incredibly is there's a huge gush of the stress hormones. And what happens is in our every brain cell has what's called an axon and a dendrite. One of those, they're like little wires. Think of a telephone with a wire coming out from each end. One of those receives signals from another neuron or brain cell. The other one passes that signal along to the next brain cell. Well, what happens when we're incredibly stressed is that the stress hormone cortisol causes those dendrites to shrink up. It's like they're cowering in the dark. And when the dendrites shrink up, that means our memories are going to be worse because the connection is not as strong as it had been. Now, studies have shown that if the stress is relieved, that the dendrites aren't dead, they're just shrunken, they retract, and then they can actually flower again. So there are many ways to reverse the effects of stress on the brain, but you have to relieve the stressor in order for that to happen.
And you know, my practice is mostly women, and they're always complaining about forgetting things or just not having that kind of sharp memory, or they notice things are happening. And it's really important to understand that stress can cause that, as you were saying, the shrinking of those dendrites and affect short-term memory, which is the area of our brain that is impacted by stress. And
absolutely, absolutely.
It's so disconcerting when you try to find that word and you can't. And that is one of the symptoms of stress, right?
Right. I mean, part of it is natural with aging, but stress really makes a huge difference regardless of what your age is in terms of your memory. One of the women I interviewed for my book had been in a very high position at Lehman Brothers when the firm crashed and went bankrupt. And she said that, I mean, several things happened. First, her eyebrows, she said, went gray, like almost overnight. She dyes them now. And she developed a twitch in her eye, and she also could not remember anything. She was carrying around sticky notes and putting them on everything so she would be able to remember. Now, her memory returned, so if you are in a circumstance like that and you're under extreme stress, like I was in this car accident, you know, don't be alarmed. Your memory is going to come back. It's just your brain needs a little time to heal. There are also things that
Can I just jump in, Thea?
Sure.
I think this is such important information because with the high profile of things like Alzheimer's disease, I think
right.
women get really scared.
That's right.
When they start seeing their memory lapsing, they can't help but wonder if maybe they're dealing with some form of dementia, which is terrifying to have that thought. And while stress is impacting our memory, which is, of course, disturbing, but it's important to know that that is, you know, more than likely the issue, and not to get stressed out about worrying whether you have something more serious going on.
Exactly, exactly. And I go through that as well. I mean, I'm a midlife woman. I go through that. But what you do is practice some mindfulness, some diaphragmatic breathing when you start to get freaked out by the thought that, oh my goodness, am I having early dementia? And because you know in your heart that what's likely happening is that you've been very, very stressed, and that really does lead to short-term memory issues. There are things we can do to stress-proof our brains, and among them is exercise. And meditation is another way to stress-proof your brain, because what meditation enables us to do is to shift our perception of events, shift our relationship to, let's say, we perceive somebody as hateful or hostile, and to be able to see that as a temporary, almost kind of flowing aspect of that person's being. And so using these tactics, you will react less strongly to stressors from the get-go. Social support is another way to stress-proof your brain. A scientist named Naomi Eisenberg in California did a really fascinating study in which she took a measure of how much social support people had over a certain period of time, and then she put them into an fMRI machine, a brain scan machine, and she had them play this game where they were supposedly going to be involved, but in fact they were excluded. It was like a video game. And, I mean, being rejected, being excluded is a very stressful circumstance. But what she found was those who had more social support in their everyday life, their brains, the pain part of their brain, which is what reacts when you feel emotional pain, that part of the brain was less reactive in those with more social support than in those with less social support.
And that just reminds me that women's brains are really different than men's brains. And for women, that social support plays out as the ability to create more oxytocin, which is this hormone of bonding, which is a calming hormone for women. So when women hang out with women and they, you know, go shopping together, or they have their coffee times together, or they have their knitting times together, whatever it is that women do when they spend time together is actually producing more oxytocin, and by feeling more bonded and more connected, we also calm down and can weather the consequences of the stressors in our life.
Well, you know, it's interesting. Oxytocin is kind of a double-edged sword. It has a dual nature. A scientist named Shelley Taylor, I don't know if you've heard of her, she's out at UCLA, and she developed this theory called tend and befriend. Everybody's heard about fight or flight. You know, when we're stressed, we go into a fight or flight mode, and that's to save our skins, essentially. What Shelley is saying is that women are more likely to go into a tend and befriend mode, meaning rather than fighting or fleeing, we will reach out to someone. We will reach out to a friend. And it's oxytocin which actually it causes us the distress to do that reaching out. So oxytocin has a very kind of complex personality. So it drives us the difference is whether the oxytocin levels are high in your brain or high in your blood. If they're higher in your brain, studies have shown that's when you feel that bonding effect. When they're higher in your blood, meaning they pass through the blood-brain barrier, that's what drives us to go and seek out someone to take care of us, someone to befriend. So oxytocin has a dual, very important dual role.
And I think the message is that part of the way to deal with stress in our life is that we need support, and we want to obviously find it in a way that is balanced and healthy, but we definitely need to be part of a support system. And it's so easy. I mean, for someone like myself, I work on my own, so I'm here and conduct my practice here and the radio shows here. And it's easy to stay here in my office all day long, my home office all day long.
And
I guess I've learned I have to be really mindful of that, because too much time on your own, even though I don't have a problem, I enjoy the space I'm in, but it can, I think we do need the benefits that happen when we are connecting. And I don't just mean that interaction time, I mean the physiological benefits, like the oxytocin and reducing stress and just feeling more support.
Right. Absolutely. Absolutely. And emailing and Facebook don't do the trick.
No.
I mean,
no.
The phone is actually quite good, and in person is even better. But you don't get nearly that same. I mean, you can get some support from emailing, or I mean, for instance, when I had my car accident, I posted on Facebook and I got tons and tons of responses, which was lovely. But it's not the same as when someone calls me up to talk to me about it.
Yeah, and that's why Skype is great too, because now we can see each other.
Yeah, I haven't figured that one out yet. That's going to come next. Another thing that's important to know is that social support can go two ways. You can reap the benefits of social support, not just by receiving it, but by giving social support. And there have been studies, there's one called Experience Corps that came out of Johns Hopkins University, that actually shows that volunteering can make a difference in terms of our cognitive abilities, in terms of being a stress reducer and therefore helping to improve cognitive abilities. So giving is as valuable as receiving when it comes to stress reduction.
And that makes sense to me, because this, when we're under stress, and it just seems, I mean, and, you know, the stories in your book really reminded me how many people are really suffering at this time, loss of jobs and illness and caregiving to parents and kids. And, you know, it's a big problem affecting so many people. And we can get so collapsed in on ourselves, you know, and into feeling that depressed state and woe is me. And while there are no doubt big challenges going on for so many people, but whenever we are in a giving mode, if we can just take a few minutes or just do pay it forward, just do something nice for someone, and it gets us out of ourselves, we actually release hormones that help us feel good.
That's right. That's absolutely right. It really, it like I said, goes both ways. Receiving, having someone give you social support, and you're giving someone social support, are equally valuable.
So I want us to move on, because you have some other great information that talks about stress and diet, and we're going to talk about stress and exercise. But I guess we're coming close to the time when we need to take a break, Thea, so I'm going to ask you to just hang in there.
Okay.
We're going to take a quick station break, and then we'll come back with some more really important information that all of us must really know to survive, not just thrive. And we're talking to Thea Singer. She's the author of Stress Less for Women, Calm Your Body, Slow Aging, and Rejuvenate the Mind in 5 Simple Steps. This is Dr. Cheryl Selman. You are listening to What Women Must Know. And don't go away. Important information for you. We'll be right back. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to What Women Must Know. This is Dr. Cheryl Selman, and we're talking with Thea Singer, who is the author of Stress Less for Women, Calm Your Body, Slow Aging, and Rejuvenate the Mind in 5 Simple Steps. Really great information, especially for this time of year. So, Thea, we were going through some of the consequences of stress, and we were going to move on and talk about the impact of stress and the diet, how it impacts our diet and our choices, and what we need to know about that. So why don't we explore this issue related to stress for a while?
Okay. Diet and stress are very much intertwined. There are many people, I am not one of them, but the majority of people are what are called stress eaters. When they get stressed, they eat more. There are some folks, like myself, who when we get stressed, we eat less. But more people eat when they're stressed than not. And what they choose to eat is the worst stuff for us. It's crunchy, greasy, fatty, potato chips, ice cream, that kind of fare. And there's a reason for this. There's actually an evolutionary necessity for this. So people shouldn't be so hard on themselves when they find themselves reaching for the potato chips when they're stressed out. And the way our stress response works is that when the stress hormones are released, everything inside of our bodies revs up. Our mind gets more alert. Our eyes see better. Our digestion shuts down because there's no need for that right now. Energy, glucose, is pushed to our muscles, our thigh muscles in particular, in case we have to flee. And so everything is on high alert. Our cardiovascular system picks up. Our heart beats faster. Our blood pressure goes up. All of this requires energy. It requires glucose, the simplest sugar. Once the stressor has passed, it's time to eat. You're a hunter-gatherer. You're out on the tundra. You're just slaying a moose for dinner. And now it's time for you to take that moose home and eat. You're starving. Well, what happens when we're stressed these days, the same physiological process kicks in. The problem is we're not doing anything physical. We're sitting in our cars in a traffic jam. So even though our minds think that we're consuming more glucose, our bodies really aren't. But our mind still has that food craving, must replenish the lost energy stores. And the reason we go to things like potato chips and ice cream is because those break down the fastest to give us that energy. Now, what happens also, if there's a double whammy involved, what happens also when we're stressed is that stress hormones turn on our reward center in our brain. This is the same part of the brain that kicks in when drugs of abuse are used. It's not to the same extent. It's a lesser degree, but it's the same process. So the reward center kicks in, and our dopamine increases. Dopamine in our brain, our neurotransmitter, is released. Now, what dopamine does is it intensifies our feelings of wanting. So we have cortisol kicking off dopamine. We've been sitting in a traffic jam, and we're totally stressed out. Our body thinks that we need to replenish energy stores. The dopamine makes that desire even stronger, and so then as soon as we have the opportunity, we go and get something to eat. Once we start eating those sweet, fatty foods, another part of our brain kicks out what are called opioids, endogenous opioids, and whereas the dopamine drives wanting, the opioids drive liking, and the opioids say, I want more of that sweet, fatty stuff. So we eat some of that sweet, fatty stuff. We're temporarily calmed. It does work as a tranquilizer momentarily because, remember, it's kicking off the pleasure center, the reward center. But then once that passes, the craving gets even greater. So we've gotten ourselves into a cycle that's remarkably similar to drug addiction.
And, you know, that is such an important point because people don't understand why they, you know, obsess about their carbs or just find themselves reaching for the carbs. It actually acts as a drug. It's stimulating those opiate receptors, and then you go through withdrawal, which makes you want to have more of it to feel good, and we're stuck. We're prisoners.
Right, and this whole chain has begun for a very good reason. It's an evolutionary reason. It was to save our skins. But the fact is that our bodies have not caught up to what our environment now is in the modern day. The stressors that we have are not fight or flight physical kinds of stressors by and large. They're in our heads. And so we're reacting in a way that would be perfectly appropriate if we were, you know, out there trying to catch dinner. But it's not appropriate when we're sitting in a traffic jam.
Yeah.
So what I try and tell people is, you know, you don't want to try and substitute carrots for potato chips because it's just not going to do the trick. Carrots aren't going to kick off your reward center. So what I recommend is that people try and find something else that brings them pleasure. If you're stressed and you want to reach for some, you know, sweet, fatty, crunchy food, what else do you like to do? One story I read was about a woman who loved to jump rope. So she stashed jump ropes in all of the closets in her house, and whenever she got that craving, she would start jumping rope. I like to go and work out. That gives me a high. So, you know, call a friend, take a mindful walk, read a book, watch a movie, do something that is going to spark that pleasure center the same way that that food would spark that pleasure center, but it won't be in an addictive way if you're using a more healthful alternative.
And there are actually foods that people can eat, and, you know, I've just listed some recipes. In fact, the recipe I'm listing on my Facebook is for a chocolate syrup that could go over fresh strawberries or raspberries this time of year, but it is totally healthy. So there's nothing in it that it actually is going to create a harmful effect. And there are so many healthy recipes that, you know, that taste good, that, you know, you can make with your own dark chocolate and natural xylitol sweeteners. So we can have our treats. We just have to upgrade them and have them around so we can make those healthy choices and not get stuck into going for the fast food when there's nothing around or we feel like we've lost our will.
Right. I have an article out in More Magazine now that actually addresses this whole issue. It has to do with foods that are healthful, foods that are good at reducing stress. And whereas it's not as if there's a whole range of them that scientifically have been proven to reduce stress, there are enough of them that we can turn to. And there's also a style of eating, mindful eating, that can really make a difference, not just in reducing stress regarding the eating process, but it reduces stress overall because you're setting a different tone for yourself for the day. Sheila West at Penn State has done studies showing that pistachio nuts actually reduce our vascular response to stressors. She had subjects and she had a physical stressor where she put their foot in cold water and also a mental stressor where they had to perform in front of, you know, people who were essentially frowning and growling. And what they found was that the vascular response, the response of their heart and their blood vessels, was less if they had eaten 1.5 to 3 ounces of pistachio nuts a day. There have also been studies looking
at... That's so interesting. Do you know why? Do you know what's in a pistachio nut?
It has to do with... you know what? The name of the actual ingredient is escaping me. It is in my book. It has to do with what's inside the nut. If you wait a second, I can probably find it. Walnuts have been shown to do the same, although the pistachio nuts, I think, had a stronger response. Low glycemic foods also have been found to correlate with a lower expression of epinephrine or adrenaline when we are stressed. There are two stress hormones that come out. The first one that we shoot out is called epinephrine or adrenaline, and the second one is the cortisol. And there was a study done at Harvard looking at boys, and it found that those who had eaten the lower glycemic foods had lower levels of epinephrine in their blood. So in my Moore article, for instance, I list a whole bunch of low glycemic foods that people can if you go online, you can actually find a whole database. You just type in the food, and it tells you what the glycemic index is for it. So that can make a difference. Chocolate, like you said, dark chocolate has been found to have stress-reducing effects as well.
Yeah, really dark chocolate, you know, 70
yeah.
or so percent. You know, as a naturopath, I also find that when people are stressed, they crave salty things.
Right.
And that's part of a physiological response to the need of our adrenal glands, which requires more minerals.
Mm-hmm.
So when the adrenals are exhausted, we need more minerals, and we crave salt because salt, again, as we evolved, is like a mineralized salt, which is how our salt was until very recent times, was a source of minerals to help the adrenals. It's always a question I ask my patients, do you crave salt? And if they do, it's a sign. It's another sign that those adrenals are needing attention.
I think especially with stress that the sweetness is really a huge correlative factor because of the glucose component. Another thing, and this is really good to know, we're talking about foods that we crave when we're stressed. There are also other foods that, in addition to pistachios, that can make a difference not only to our stress levels, but also to the aging of our cells. And one of these is omega-3 fatty acids. We've read a lot about omega-3 fatty acids and how good they are for cognition. There have been a lot of studies with that, fish oil. But there was a study done out at UCSF that looked at a group of men who had stable cardiac disease. They had cardiac disease, but they were up and they were functioning. Some of them were on medication. And what the scientist wanted to look at was he looked at telomere length over a period of time in these men. And he found that in some of these men, the telomeres had actually lengthened. So this is really excellent news. Telomeres don't only shorten, they can actually lengthen. And the reason they can lengthen is there's an enzyme called telomerase, which can come and it can dab on little extra bits of telomeres onto those tips at the ends of our cells. And there are certain activities, like meditation, for instance, has been shown to boost levels of telomerase. And what the scientists found was that those whose telomeres had lengthened over a period of 5 years, the one factor that was different was that they had higher levels of omega-3 fatty acids in their blood.
Right, isn't that interesting? So
yeah.
It's important for us to take a good quality fish oil or some good source of omega-3s. There are also plant-based sources.
Right.
As a fundamental part of our nutritional program.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So it's, not just the cognitive benefits, which we've been hearing about for a long time, but there also appear to be benefits regarding cellular aging, that omega-3 fatty acids correlate with a reversal of cellular aging, which is really very encouraging.
Yeah, isn't that great? Because,
yeah.
I mean, to know that we can actually lengthen our telomeres is fantastic news, and whether science has gotten to the point where they actually state it, but it's indicating that it's helping us to get younger and healthier as we get older, essentially.
That's right. That's right. Also, there have been studies showing that dieting, rigid dieting, and tracking what you eat raises levels of stress hormones. So what I recommend in my book is I have Walt Willett's Healthy Eating Pyramid out of the Harvard School of Public Health,
right,
which enables you to make your own wise choices. It's not putting you on a regimen in which you can eat this, you can't eat that. Ultimately, we feel stressed when we feel out of control, when we're overwhelmed. So what we want to work to do is to increase our perception of the control that we have over our environment and our lives.
Yeah, and I always find, and I recommend, as much as possible, is to stock your house with healthy food. So when you do have the need to, binge a bit, you're binging on only healthy options. You just don't even have a stash of that candy ready to be, gone into. You have lots of healthy options. Makes it a lot easier.
That's a huge key, and not just stock your house with them, but put them out on the counter. So that, when you get hungry and you're going to have an impulse eat, you go to something that's sitting right there for you.
Right, yeah. Well, what about exercise? Because I know you've written about that. I know you said you use exercise a lot to help you with stress. What has the research found about exercise and stress?
The research has found that exercise, if there's one thing you're going to do, and of course there are many things we should do to make our lives more healthful, if there's one thing you should do because you want to stay young or you want to reverse the aging process, it's exercise. I mean, I have talked to aging experts and they say if you could put exercise in pill form, that would be the best, anti-aging medication you would ever have. Exercise is really quite remarkable. As I mentioned, it can produce neurogenesis. It can make us grow new brain cells. It also has been found, there was a study done in Canada by a scientist named Mark Tarnopolsky, and he looked at older adults and the effect of resistance exercise on their cells. And what he found was that those who went through his exercise program, resistance exercise program, the genetic profile of their muscle cells reverted to the genetic profile of younger people's muscle cells. So there are things we can do through exercise to actually reverse the aging process.
You know, that's so interesting. I've actually started a program of resistance training, and I do it a half hour three times a week. I work with a trainer, which I have finally realized it's worth the money, because mm-hmm. you can accomplish so much more if you have a trainer guiding you than if you go and do it on your own. I just don't push myself the way a trainer does. But what I've noticed is that because I've been focusing on, through resistance training, building muscle mass, which I was never very good at, to be mm-hmm. honest. I really did not have strong muscles. I tended to have more flaccid muscle tone. Mm-hmm. It's been phenomenal. I have really been building more muscle. I see it in my arms. And what I found, part of that, the key to the success, is to combine the resistance training with whey protein or some sort of protein or branched-chain amino acids, which are specific amino acids that can then go in and rebuild the muscle. When I combine the exercise with the proper nutritional support, you get mm-hmm. much better results. But it's so big an issue. It's so important for healthy aging to have strong muscle mass.
You should actually look up some of the work of Mark Konopolsky.
Uh-huh.
He's in my book because he is not only a scientist and a medical doctor, but he is also, what is it called that he does? It's this intense, it's not triathlon, it's something very intense where you're like out for the whole day running and skiing, and I mean he's a huge athlete, and he actually does a lot of studies looking at additives with the resistance training, so you might find some interesting studies there that support what you're saying.
Oh, I will. That's great. Yeah.
Because
that's such, first of all, stress will break down muscle mass. And I think that is such an important point for people to understand. When you're under stress, our stress hormone cortisol actually breaks down tissue. So many women have reported that when they're under stress, they seem to be losing their muscle tone and, you know, muscle shape and strength.
Yeah. Part of what's going on there is that your immune system becomes dampened. So that if there's some injury to that muscle mass, your body can't repair it in the way that it could have were you not under that stress. So your immune system really takes a whipping when you're under chronic stress. All of us have probably experienced, you know, our final exam time a million years ago, of course, when, we took the exam and then we collapsed and we got sick. And it is because stress really does a number on your immune system, and your immune system is racing to try and keep up and catch up, and it just can't do it. So that's part of the wear and tear that happens from increased levels of cortisol.
And I think it comes back to an important point you made earlier that we need to emphasize again, and that's the role of meditation, which I think is a strategy for life, if not mm-hmm. rejuvenation. It's not an option for women, especially.
Right. The studies on meditation, there are many studies on meditation. Some are rigorous, some are not rigorous. But the ones that, for instance, have been done by Jon Kabat-Zinn with mindfulness-based stress reduction out at UMass Medical Center have shown a huge difference in stress response for people who have gone through the MBSR program. Not that I'm advocating that particular type. Even if you can't find it in yourself to sit and meditate, go for a 10-minute mindful walk, you know. Notice the leaves and the veins on the leaves and the gravel crunching under your feet. Something that seems that small can make a huge difference in your perspective for the entire day.
Yeah, you know, this is wonderful information, Thea. Is there anything else before we come to the end of the show that you feel you want to share that we haven't touched on so far?
One thing that's very important is getting enough sleep. If you are sleep deprived, there are many studies showing that if you are sleep deprived, your hormones are out of whack, your leptin and ghrelin is out of whack. I remember when I was in college and I would pull all-nighters and I think, oh, I'm starving in the morning because I've been using so much energy to write this paper. But in fact, what happens when you don't sleep, your leptin levels and ghrelin levels get thrown off. Leptin is the hormone that tells you when you're full. It's produced by fat cells, and ghrelin is the hormone that's produced by cells in your stomach. It tells you when to eat. And what happens when you are incredibly stressed out is that your leptin levels go down, so you think you're hungry even though you're really not. Your body doesn't really need the food. So, and then another bad effect is that it's been shown that when you don't get enough sleep and you do eat, the fat deposits itself preferentially in your belly, which is the worst place for the fat to be. So one thing that we really have to remember is that sleep, getting enough sleep for each of us to feel refreshed, is crucial. It's not an option. It's crucial. In my book, what I say is you wouldn't get into the shower and step out before you'd rinsed all the soap off. So you need to get enough sleep in order to feel refreshed. It's that important.
And we are a sleep-deprived culture, I have to say. So I personally do a lot of things to ensure that I get a good night's sleep. So I take a lot of my own medicine here, my supplements, my natural supplements.
Mm-hmm. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to ask you in the last few minutes that we have, just kind of recap some of your favorite and proven strategies to help reverse the consequences of stress. What are some of the things that we really all must be doing to keep up?
Okay, well, for starters, I would say exercise, and studies have shown that the recommended amount by the CDC is really correlates with less cellular aging. That's 150 minutes of moderate intensity aerobic exercise a week. It's really not that much if you count in, you know, walking from your car to your workplace or whatever. One thing I really like, Judith Moskowitz is out at UCSF, and she has strategies that she suggested for reducing negativity, countering negativity, and one of my favorite ones has to do with reinterpreting a negative experience. For instance, an example I like to use is I went to my gym to work out. I left my headphones in my car. I started getting really aggravated. And then I said, you know what? Let's take walking back to the car and then walking back to the gym as a warm-up period, rather than seeing it as something getting in the way of my starting my warm-up period. And so that relieved my stress. And when I got on the bike, I could start pedaling away much more strongly and at a higher intensity than I could before. Sleep is really important. If you have trouble sleeping, take a hot bath 90 minutes before you go to bed. A process called thermoregulation kicks in, and the minute you get out of the bath, your body cools down, and that's the state your body needs to be in order for the most restful, slow-wave sleep to take effect. And breathe. Remember to breathe. Breathe diaphragmatically. You know, inhale and pause at the end of the inhale, let your belly extend, and then exhale slowly. The breath rate should be 4 breaths per minute or slower. That's 15 seconds or longer for each breath. It's remarkable what a difference just breathing can make in reducing your stress levels.
Okay, in the 1 minute we have left, Thea, why don't we let people know how to find your book, Stress Less for Women, Calm Your Body, Slow Aging, and Rejuvenate the Mind in 5 Simple Steps.
Okay, you can go. The book comes out on December 27th, so you will be able to find it in your bookstores. You can go to Amazon to get it or Barnes & Noble. You can pre-order the book now. If you go to my website, theasinger.com, you can click into any of those online sites to buy the book. So there's a lot of places where you are able to pick it up.
Well, I just really want to congratulate you again on a great book, and good luck with this edition. It's wonderful. I do recommend people pick up a copy of Stress Less for Women by Thea Singer. Thea, thank you so much for your time today and all the great research you have done.
Thank you so much. It's been great talking to you.
Okay. Take care and happy holidays.
Okay. You too. Bye-bye.
Bye now. And for all of you listening, I hope you've gotten some great tips today. It really is important
to beat stress, we can't avoid it, but we can certainly manage it by taking the right strategies and putting them into action, putting into play. So for all of you, I wish you a great day, and remember, always honor the wisdom of your feminine self. Bye for now.